email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Matt's been on. You'd have to have a film about the board game Buckaroo. The whole film will be about trying to get items on a donkey. A classic, says Matt. Now, film director and writer Neil Jordan and his friend Robert Mahery made a generous donation to the Hugh Lane Gallery, and Neil is on the line to tell us about it. Good afternoon, Neil.
Hi, Ray. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Yeah. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, yeah.
So, yourself... Why are you laughing?
I didn't think I'd be on the radio, on the Ray Darcy Show, talking about this, but anyway, let's go, yeah. Cool.
Part of the reason I want to talk to you, firstly, is about this, and secondly, is about your book, Well of Say Nobody, which I really enjoyed and read at the end of last year.
Oh, thank you. Oh, great,
and,
okay.
Yeah, and I gave it to Graham Norton, and I gave it to my mum. I don't know, I didn't get a review back from Graham Norton, but my mum loved it. So there you go.
Okay, well, your mum is the best.
Yes, okay. So, Richard Gorman is an Irish abstract painter, and yourself and Robert Mahery, did you buy them and just give them to Hugh Lane Gallery, or did you have them in your possession?
I'll tell you what happened. Richard had an exhibition, late last year in the Hugh Lane Gallery, which is a beautiful place. Every Dubliner should go there. It's absolutely gorgeous, yeah. With a great collection, and with Francis Bacon's actual studio, kind of recreated there. Anyway, there was a beautiful set of Japanese, I wouldn't call them prints really, but they're kind of Japanese circular themed wall hanging, really, you know. And I said to Barbara, this is so beautiful, you should leave it here permanently. She said, well, we'd have to get someone to pay for it, Neil, why don't you do it? Now, I don't normally do that kind of thing. I wouldn't think I'm a wealthy person, but I did speak to Robert, who is a friend of Richard's and has been a supporter of his for many years, and you know, we bought the piece and donated to the gallery, and they have a rather wonderful exhibition there that is that includes Richard's piece, a piece by Sean Scully, what's that wonderful?
And these have all been donated by people like yourself.
By various people, have been. And it goes right back to Hugh Lane's original donations himself, you know. Uh-huh. And it's a great exhibition, and everybody should go there. And it's wonderful, rather wonderful to see Richard's work there in the company of all these other donated works that go back to the Hugh Lane period itself.
And Neil, Richard works on, will you pronounce it there, the paper he works on?
It's a kind of a Japanese paper, Japanese kind of rice paper, I think,
rice,
or a special Japanese paper. And the oils are kind of embedded within the paper itself. It's an extraordinary thing to see. It's a beautiful piece of work, even if you don't know how it was made. He also has a wonderful piece of sculpture in Bray that I think he was commissioned in a new development off Main Street, you know.
Right.
And he's done this extraordinary piece of steel sculpture there that will be there forever, which people should see as well, yeah.
Now, you're in the middle of casting for an adaptation of your own book, The Well of Say Nobody.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful story, and I thought it would make a lovely movie. I began to write a script on it. Well, I say it's a beautiful, I wrote it myself. Come on, it's the novel I wrote. And I began to write a script, and it came out rather naturally into a movie, you know? And it's about music. It's about two people who have misunderstood each other through their entire lives. It's about, there's a murder in it too, you know? It's kind of, it's a really, really interesting dynamic piece about, kind of eroticism around people in their 60s and 70s, which is strange. I know that's not a great draw to cinema audiences, but I want to make it, and I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it this year.
So William is a classical pianist, and Tara was a fan of his over the years, but he was completely unaware of her.
Totally.
Yeah, and he ends up in West Cork in a rectory. She's a local piano teacher. He's afflicted by some condition,
psoriasis,
and so he can't play. And then she sees the sign up. He wants a housekeeper, and she volunteers, and it goes.
Initially, she wants to punish him.
Yes,
you know, for his lack of recognition of her throughout the years. But then something changes. They find a well on the property, and she begins to invent stories about it. And something changes, and the relationship changes, and it kind of becomes kind of a love story.
Yeah.
I'm describing it. You should describe it, Ray.
No. Well, I loved the book. I loved it. And I picked it up because I was curious, you see. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, some, you get into conversations and people say, what are you reading? And I'd say, I'm reading Neil Jordan's novel. And most people, what was their response, Neil?
I didn't know Neil Jordan wrote novels.
That's exactly it.
I've been writing for years. You know, yeah. I mean, the first published thing I had was a book of stories called Night in Tunisia.
Yeah.
And it's just because, I don't know, once you get some kind of minimal kind of acclaim as a filmmaker, everybody seems to forget that you ever wrote a book, you know. But I've been writing since 1976, and I have continued to do that, you know. And I'm glad I do, because, you know, the films are changing and movies are becoming tougher and tougher as a kind of an environment to work in. But, you know, this is going to be a beautiful thing, and it'll probably be more forgiving than most of the movies I've made, because a lot of the films I've made are kind of savage, you know, and this is about reconciliation in some way.
And it's against the backdrop of West Cork. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you love that, mm-hmm. So that'll star in the movie as well, I suppose.
Well, we all love the Irish landscape, don't we? We like every bit of the Atlantic that hits the coast, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I do spend a lot of time down in the Berra Peninsula, but this will not be set there. It'll be set, you know, around... actually, where Jeremy lives, actually. Sorry, around... I shouldn't mention any names, but it'll be set...
He'd be perfect for it. He'd be perfect for it. Jeremy Hines.
You think so? No, I'm not.
Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons.
I haven't cast the movie yet. Okay, sorry.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So Ballydehob is...
It'll be set around that area. There are different... I mean, Cork is the biggest county in Ireland, as you're all aware, aren't you? There's East Cork, there's Midland, there's West Cork, there's kind of Middle Cork, and there's Cork itself, Cork City,
Here's the thing, when you were writing the book, The Well of St. Nobody, was it at the back of your mind that it would be a movie, or how does that process work?
I never know whether what I'm writing will become a movie or become a novel, you know, and I'll tell you exactly what happened, actually. I was hit by kind of arthritic psoriasis in my hands. Now, I play music quite a bit, you know, not very well. But
what did you play?
I used to play the classical guitar quite a bit, you know, and I used to play the saxophone, and I play a bit of piano. But I was a very good classical guitarist. I was never a good saxophone player or piano player. But, you know, I play anything with a string on it, I try to play. Okay. Anyway, I found I couldn't actually do it. I couldn't even hold an instrument in my hand, you know. I couldn't even move my fingers over a piano. And I had been obsessed with this story. It's a movie made by a director called Max Ophuls. It's called Letter from an Unknown Woman. And it has the same premise as this novel and as the movie I'm going to make, which is a pianist and a young acolyte who meets him 3 or 4 times, and he always thinks every time he meets her, he's meeting a different person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this was set in the 40s, and, you know, it's kind of got the romanticism of those middle European kind of Hollywood kind of movies. But, you know, what I wrote was a bit more savage than that. But I've taken that basic story and brought it up to date in a way, and I kind of based it around myself as somebody who can't function, can't even hit a typewriter anymore. I can't play the piano, definitely can't play Bach on the guitar anymore, you know, that kind of thing. So
it still affects you, does it, Neil?
Pardon?
It's gone. It's gone. Okay. Right? Okay.
Most of these things are mysterious, you know. I mean, I went to so many meetings with people who deal with skin. What is the doctor who deals
dermatologist.
With skin?
Dermatologist.
With dermatologists.
Yeah.
Believe me, I came to hate them, you know.
Yeah.
And they all had different solutions. Try this, try that, try that. And I was saying to them, look, I've had this when I was younger. It always goes and I never know why. It comes, I don't know why. It goes, I don't know why. And it just went, you know. So
Was it stress related? Here's me.
Of course.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Oh, you're a doctor too. You're a dermatologist. Yeah. Give me a few tinctures.
I spent enough time with dermatologists when I was a kid and wanted to be a doctor, but there is a connection.
It's like most of these things, you know, they come and go and you don't know why. And I think life is mysterious, and that's what the book is about. And I hope that's what the movie will be about.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. So, casting, how difficult is that? Do you have a list? Do you have a whiteboard, or how does it work?
You talk to various well-known actors. You say, do you want to be in my movie? They say, maybe, I'm not sure, I'm busy. Okay, that's the way it goes, basically. You know, it's actually a very difficult thing at the moment, because there's been a big actor strike, for one thing, you know, that people have probably forgotten about now. And there are all these huge Netflix and television kind of series going on, which provides, you know, great employment for actors, you know, so a lot of the people you would want to get engaged with tend to be busy, you know.
And I suppose they've been offered 10-hour-long things, and that takes a lot longer.
They are kind of. So but more, I mean, the truth is that, you know, movies are in a bit of crisis at the moment, and actually moments of crisis are often the best when the best kind of things arise, you know. Mm. So at the moment it seems like
you'd be hopeful enough, though. Like we watched Past Lives, and Anatomy of a Fall, a beautiful film,
yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, I was surprised even to see that in the cinema, and it was so beautifully realised and so emotional.
Yeah, what a lovely film. Yeah, so there is stuff out there worth watching.
Oh, absolutely.
With superheroes this year,
there was a big crisis. The crisis in cinema has gone on for the last 5 years, but this year there were great movies in the. You know, in the cinemas, and a lot of them were offbeat ones. A lot of them were the kind of movies you wouldn't expect to see studios making, but they made them.
I suppose everyone's asking you about Cillian Murphy because he was in Breakfast on Pluto.
Cillian, he was. Yeah, I remember that. That's a long time ago already.
Yeah, I know, but I suppose...
He was a pretty girl then.
He was a pretty girl, yes.
Now he's an elegant man.
The talent was always there, and obviously spotted by you, you wouldn't have cast him.
No. Everybody who knew Cillian, everyone who saw him on stage realised there was something special there. I saw him in a small movie. I mean, the first movie that most big audiences saw him in was 28 Days Later, wasn't it? That Danny Boyle film, you know? And he was actually Disco Pigs as well, but I mean, the first time, you know, broader audiences became aware of him was that performance in 28 Days Later. And, you know, you kind of saw commitment there, not only the commitment to the psychological commitment of an actor, but the physical commitment, you know, he approached that movie the way an athlete would approach a race or something, you know. So Cillian's got a lot of stuff going, you know. He's a totally engaged actor.
Yeah. Breakfast on Pluto, Pat McCabe, and of course you did Butcher Boy with Pat McCabe as well. Brilliant Irish writer.
Yes.
And how did that? Because I'm a huge fan of his, huge fan of yours as well. I'm intrigued as to how that came about. Did you read the book and go, "I have to make a movie out of this"? Or
You mean the Butcher Boy?
Yeah.
I read Pat McCabe's Butcher Boy. I didn't know Pat from Adam. I read the novel and I thought it was quite extraordinary. I called him up. At the time, I had a big deal with Warner Brothers. You know, there were the days when people like me had development deals with studios. You know, they don't happen anymore. And I called Pat up and he came out to meet me and I said, "Look, I'd love to make a movie of your book." So he sold me the rights to it, and then I asked Pat. He said he'd like to have a go at the script himself. So I said, "Okay, go ahead." And he wrote a version. He wrote a script that was like a parallel version of the book, but nothing to do with the book, you know. And I said, "Pat, I kind of like the book that you wrote, you know. I mean, you can't rewrite it again, you know." He said, "Oh, okay." So I said, "Look, give it a go myself, you know." So I kind of dived into the book myself, and we came up with a script that was rather wonderful, you know. And you know, the people said at the time you couldn't possibly make it into a movie, and that was part of the attraction for me, you know.
The defiance.
It's not the defiance, really. I just saw something in it that was both surreal and that was driven by a voice, the voice of the kid. Initially, Pat didn't want to use a voiceover at all because he thought that voiceover was a bad idea in movies. But I said, "No, look, it's Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange. You know, there's many great movies with voiceovers." You know, so we made the movie, and it was made by Warner Brothers. And at the time, they gave us a very generous budget to make it. They didn't understand it at all. But, you know, audiences loved it. You know, I'm very proud of that film.
Yeah.
And then he came out with Breakfast on Pluto. And I bought the rights to that as well. I was kind of a bit nervous of that because I'd made The Crying Game, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
And it was another treatment of a kind of a trans character. And I'd wrote the script with Pat, and I had great fun doing it because it brought me back to the times that I was in London. And, you know, anyone who grew up in the 70s remembers the situation of being an Irish person in London and blamed for every bomb attack that ever happened and that kind of thing, you know. And, you know, so we wrote this script that reflected all of that experience, and Cillian read it and loved it. And he asked me to play the character, so I did a test with Cillian, and he was extraordinary. But I still was unsure, do I really want to approach these issues again? And Cillian kept saying, we have to make this film. We have to, and he was right in the end, because we made it, and his performance was extraordinary, you know.
And just back to Butch Boy, you cast the late Sinead O'Connor as the Virgin Mary.
Yes, I did.
In Butcher Boy.
Yeah. And she played it without a question. I didn't realize she had... Well, I kind of knew in a way, you know. She has... At the time, she had a house that she used to collect statues of the BVM, as she called her, you know.
Right. The Blessed Virgin Mary, the BVM.
Yeah, no, I mean, I knew Sinead, and I'd seen her. I'd seen her in that movie she made in Derry with Margot Harkin. And, you know, this. I thought this a great, there's a real performance there. And she, her face, she got this purity that she looks just like those statues of the Virgin Mary. So, you know, she agreed to play it, and she gave a great performance, yeah.
Yeah. What is it? Can I ask you that question? Because you know that purity, the face, you know, and the still. People talk about the stillness as well in an actor like Cillian Murphy has that, and you don't know it until you see it on screen. Is that it, or have
it's
you?
Hard to just, it's really hard to describe. I think the reason that non-actors like Sinead, you know, because Sinead is a non-actor really. And like Eamon Owens, who played in the Butcher Boy, that was his first performance. Yeah. They do something because there's a total utter unself-consciousness about the performance of the presentation. In other words, they don't act, and that turns out to be more powerful than acting. You know, and the very great actors like Cillian, like Stephen Ray, like Robert De Niro, like
Tom Cruise,
you know,
Peter O'Toole. You've worked with all of those.
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, you know, like Saoirse Ronan, you know, they managed to have this way of putting themselves into the character, into the part, without any sense of performance or pretending being there in a strange way, you know. And that's what you demand of, that's what one wants from a great actor. And I think, I mean, I've tended to work with actors, non-actors, and put them alongside actors, at, you know, like, for example, when I did Interview the Vampire with Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and Kirsten Dunst. It was their first real performance, yeah. But what happens is the actors, they kind of get jealous of this immediacy that these kids have, you know?
Right.
Because with the kids, there's no need for pretense. And it's a really interesting kind of... And
dynamic,
it ups everybody's game. It ups, you know, it ups Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt's game, and it ups...
That's counterintuitive, Neil, isn't it? It's counterintuitive that the new person ups the game of the... Well, maybe it isn't.
Well, I mean, you want to make things fresh, don't you? And nobody will make things fresher than somebody who's never acted before. Like Jay Davidson in The Crying Game.
Yeah.
Jay had never acted ever, never even thought of acting, but... You know, and he gives this performance that is so immediate and so kind of true in a way that the other actors have to, they realize, oh God, I've got to really be on my toes here.
Yeah. I believe you're working on a memoir, or is it finished?
It's finished.
It's finished.
It'll be out in June. I've written a memoir, yeah.
How was that for you?
It was weird. It was fun. It was weird, though. You know, I mean, it's weird looking at your own life and looking at the various things you've done. And, you know, actually looking at your parents' lives and, you know, not, you know, I mean, I was just asked to write it, so I began writing it, I thought, and I wrote one chapter about my mother when she was kind of ill, driving up back to the place she was born, and I said, and I just kept writing and writing and writing, and it eventually came up with something that people seem to regard as interesting, so it'll be out towards the middle of June, I think.
Who would play you in the film adaptation?
Me? Yeah. Oh my God, I don't know. You'd need about 25 people, but there won't be a film adaptation of this. Believe me, no.
And is there a name? Is there? Do you have to come up with a name for those things?
Oh yeah, I came up with a name. It's called Amnesiac.
Right, Amnesiac.
Amnesiac. Yeah.
Right.
Now, I just chose that name because actually there wasn't a book called Amnesiac.
Right.
And I said, okay, I'm going to have that title. But it also has some relevance because we're never sure that we remember correctly, are we?
No.
You know?
No.
And any one person's memory, even my sisters and my, you know, my kids or my wife's memory of any one event could be quite different from your own memory of it, you know. So I've just called it Amnesia because there's a bit of a pun there as well.
It's fascinating. I've read a lot about memory and we replace things. Every time we remember something, the next time we remember it differently. Because if you tell a story about something that happened to you, you might embellish it slightly and that becomes, in your head, sometimes factual. So the next time...
Absolutely. I mean, I've told stories that... I'm convinced I witnessed that. I know I never witnessed, you know. Particularly before, you know, particularly before you reach the age of kind of memory itself, really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure everybody has some kind of imagined memory of themselves being in a pram or something like that.
You couldn't have any memory of it.
You're never sure whether it was you remember that, or your parents told you, or the vista you saw was a photograph that reminds you of something. And you know,
it's fascinating. And by calling it a memoir, it doesn't have to be factually correct anyway, does it? Is that the deal?
Oh, well, it kind of has to be. You can't tell lies about people.
I know.
You know, you can't tell lies. You can't say this happened when it didn't happen.
But what's
you
your understanding of a memoir versus an autobiography?
Oh, I suppose an autobiography, you think you're important enough to that your life is interesting to other people, whereas a memoir is more subjective in a way, isn't
right,
it?
I suppose,
more drifting, right. You know, I hope.
So the Hugh Lane Gallery, you can go and see the work of Richard Gorman.
And Sean Scully. And Alexander Calder.
And all of that. And it's there, it's ongoing. And you're casting The Well of St. Nobody, and we'll see that at some stage in the future.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. And
okay.
Thanks so much for your time, Neil. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Goodbye now.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.